No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in with your comments or questions at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. First, let me say hello to my co-host, Maria, who's been in Washington lately, so I got to see her personally, and that was great. Maria, how you doing?
Fabulous.
After your long journey back home. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It was great. And after Dr. Pilon's time is finished with us, we can talk in a little bit more details about what went on this weekend and how wonderful and brilliant you were.
Oh, come on. All right. Now, after that build up, I've got to be wonderful and brilliant. So let me bring on our guest for tonight, Dr. Roger Pilon, who holds the Cato Institute B. Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies, which he's held since it was established in 1998. He joined Cato as a senior fellow in October 1988 and has been there until 2019, has served as the director of Cato's Center for Constitutional Studies, which he founded in 1989. Dr. Pilon is also an attorney at law, I believe. He's a lawyer, so which is great because he's a constitutional expert, and we're grateful to have you here, Doctor. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, it's good to be with you, Senator Brown.
And you know what? I've studied the Constitution, but I certainly have a layman's view of the Constitution because I never studied law. I studied political science and public policy in graduate school. So I have some sense of it, but it's great to have an expert on. And I think you're the first expert in the Constitution, even though we've been on the air for 6 years. I think you're the first constitutional expert we've had on. So thanks so much. Let's start at the beginning. Disagreement seems to come over a single clause in the Constitution. I think it's generally referred to as the Enclave Clause. We call it the D.C. Clause. But it says that Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may by the secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States. Tell us what that means, Dr. Pilon. What do you think that means to us in terms of our quest to become the 51st state?
Well, that was the clause that the framers put into the Constitution to establish a separate district where the new federal government would exist, be brought into being, that would be independent from any one of the states. They had, had the capital located in New York and then in Philadelphia, and they had experienced some problems there. For example, in 1783, there was an attack upon the members of Congress that neither the state nor the city police forces were prepared to resist, and they had to flee to Princeton. And so they wanted to avoid that in future when the new Constitution was drafted. And that's why they put in the enclave clause that it shall be a district no larger than 10 miles square. Now, the effort in recent years has been to bring about D.C. statehood by focusing on the language of that clause. And the most recent example was H.R. 51, which was addressed in hearings back in September. It is an effort, and I think we need to set forth the facts of that bill first, because mm-hmm. that will give us a sense of what it is we're factually working on here. What the bill would do is authorize Congress to create the 51st state by reducing the size of the district to a tiny enclave around the National Mall, including, for example, the White House, the Supreme Court, obviously Congress, and a number of other federal buildings. But it would be a vast reduction in what today is the District of Columbia, and the rest of the current district would constitute this 51st state. Now, the rationale behind that, as there was also in a bill that was introduced in 2013, is focusing on the language in that clause, which says no greater than 10 miles square, the implication being that Congress can make it much smaller. But we are talking here about an effort to do that, and not so much through the enclave clause, but granting permission, as it were, from this language I just mentioned in the enclave clause, but then to do it through Article 4, Section 3, which is a very different clause. That's for bringing states into the Union from federal territory. So you've got in H.R. 51 a combination, as it were, of these two distinct clauses. And my first objection to that, and as you know, Senator Brown, I testified in September against H.R. 51.
Yes.
My main objection was constitutional, and it started from the idea that the District of Columbia is sui generis. It's not like any, it never was, never meant to be a federal territory like, for example, the Northwest Territory, the Southwest Territory, the land we got from France under President Jefferson, and so forth. It was never meant to be of that kind. It was meant to be precisely, in plain language, expressly, the seat of the federal government. And so the idea of moving from the enclave clause to the territorial clause, it seems to me, is a stretch that is going to immediately raise constitutional objections. So I'll stop there and let you take it from that.
I mean, I think we all concede that there will be legal challenges to what we're trying to do. But let me ask you something. Aren't we a federal territory? I mean, we are. That really is our status, is it not?
That is true. But it's a federal territory of a very unique kind. In fact, it was created as the seat of the federal government, not as a territory that would be expected to be turned into a state like Utah or Kansas or Minnesota or what have you. This was not ever contemplated to be a state. It was contemplated, and expressly so, to be the seat of the federal government.
Well, this may sound strange to you, Doctor, since I'm someone who has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. But let me ask you very frankly, why should we care about what the framers wanted in this particular instance? And I ask you that question in the context of the fact that they didn't want women to vote. They didn't want Native Americans to vote. They didn't want African Americans to vote. The framers were not a bunch of inclusive people. They were trying a new experiment, were they not? Democracy was a great experiment, and they really weren't sure how the federal government would, how powerful it would be juxtaposed to state governments. So was that not part of their mindset, that they were afraid the federal government would be ruled by the state?
Well, I am glad that you have posed the question as you have, because the examples that you cited were all brought about by constitutional amendment. And so my main point, the bottom line in all of this, is that this can be done, this 51st state, but it has to be done by constitutional amendment. And that's a point that has been held by the Justice Departments that have been presented with this question ever since the time of Robert Kennedy's being Attorney General, 1963 in particular. Each time this has been presented to the Justice Department, they have said it requires to be done through a constitutional amendment, just like the franchise for women, just like the vote for the freed black slaves in the 15th Amendment, and so on and so forth.
But that wasn't true in the case of Native Americans. Wait a second. That wasn't true in the case of Native Americans. They were given full citizenship in 1924, and they still maintain their sovereignty, right? They can have things like gambling casinos and things on the reservation. They have their own government. But they also have full citizenship, where the Indians, for example, in Minnesota or California, are also represented by the senators and congressmen from those states.
Yeah, they're not represented by a creation of a new set of senators and congressmen. They're represented by the congressmen and senators in the states in which their reservations are located. And of course, the Indians, the Native Americans, constitute a unique class because their relationship to the United States is by treaty as provided for in the Constitution. I think
Maria, go ahead.
Thank you. So, Dr. Pilon, if the District of Columbia was to pursue this in the methodology that you just suggested, you don't necessarily have a personal objection to the statehood scenario. You have a legal objection.
Even more, a constitutional.
Right.
Because, I mean, the examples that Senator Brown articulated, for example, were changed, but they were changed by constitutional amendment. And as I said, that's what the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel has held in the several times that the issue has been presented to it.
And has anything ever been done about that, Michael, to start that?
Well, I think that I would argue that Dr. Pilon isn't, you know, that's a little inaccurate in that we really haven't put forth a statehood bill that's, in my understanding anyway, has gotten that ruling. It's been ruled on other grounds. Or for other legislation, for example, we had a voting rights amendment that was put in, and I think that was the ruling. And the court has found many times that what our struggle is, in fact, the court has said that our struggle is a political struggle. It's not a it's not something that we can take up in the courts. We can't be, we can't plead the 14th Amendment, for example. Equal protection, because I guess you cannot, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Dr. Pilon, but it seems to me that you cannot have something declared unconstitutional which is actually in the Constitution. So,
the clearest example of that is when you try to declare the death penalty unconstitutional when the Constitution mentions no fewer than three times capital crimes.
Yeah, and am I wrong about this, Dr. Pilon, or is the what we call the district clause, is that the only place in the Constitution, it's the only place I've ever seen in the Constitution where they use the term in all cases, what legislation in all cases whatsoever. Is in all cases whatsoever more common than I'm aware in the Constitution?
I can't answer that off the top of my head. I'd have to do a word search. But the point of the language is that the Congress has plenary authority over the District of Columbia. Now, of course, it has delegated a fair measure of that authority under home rule. But the other question that we haven't raised so far in this discussion is the 23rd Amendment. And there, even the person testifying for the district in these September hearings raised substantial concerns about the 23rd Amendment, that it would have to be repealed, and of course that would be repealed through another amendment, just like the 18th Amendment was repealed by the 21st Amendment. You can't do it by legislation. And so you see, all these bills are an attempt to do through legislation what really has to be done through constitutional amendment. In my judgment and the judgment of many other people who have looked at this issue. And so that's where we come down to the bottom line, quite apart from all the practical reasons, that Madison and others raised, and that then have been raised since then. These constitutional issues are just staring us right there in the face, and they are unaddressed to this point because it just hasn't gotten to to the courts to do so.
Well, let me ask you, since have the Constitution delegates to Congress legislation in all cases whatsoever, why can't we legislate out the 23rd Amendment to the Constitution? Why can't, as part of the legislation, I think that's been part of the bill in the past, that there would be an immediate repeal of the 23rd Amendment? And for those listeners who may not understand what the issue is here, we were given the right to vote for president and given as many electoral votes as the smallest state by the 23rd Amendment. We couldn't vote for president. Lyndon Johnson was the first president we got to vote for. So if we were to, the argument is, if we were to pass this and the 23rd Amendment stayed intact the way it is, we would actually have twice as many electoral votes as we are entitled to, and the people. Presumably the president and the first family would get three electoral votes of their own. But let me ask you, why is it that it has to be changed by constitutional amendment and can't be legislated if the Congress has the power in all cases whatsoever?
Because the district was created pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, and it cannot be changed by mere statute. Constitutional provisions, there's another issue, too, and it's a fraught issue. It's whether Congress, having done this, has the power to undo that when it involved a grant from the states of Maryland and Virginia for the express purpose. Now, that implies, or that certainly strongly suggests, that at least in the case of Maryland, because Virginia was never litigated on the merits with the retrocession of that took place in the 19th century and was attempted to be litigated 30 years later. But in the case of Maryland, that grant was made expressly for the creation of the District of Columbia as the seat of government. And therefore, you would seem to require, it strongly suggests, that we need the consent of Maryland to change that.
Well, I noticed that was an answer. You and I testified before the United States Senate on a similar bill, and Senator Carper asked you that question, and that was your response. And my reaction to that, Dr. Pilon, is don't we have other situations? I mean, let's take Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. It takes up more than a third of the state of Nevada, and it was ceded to the federal government, was it not, for an Air Force base? So are you saying that if the federal government decided that they wanted to take part of that land and use it for another purpose, that they would have to ask the state of Nevada whether they could do that or not?
Well, that is an implication of what I'm saying, and I don't think it would I don't think that my argument would carry in that case, but that means that I fall back on the argument that the district is not like the Air Force Base. It was never meant to be a federal territory with the idea that it would one day become a state like the Northwest Territory and so on. And so, again, this is a sui generis, a very unique district, not a federal territory, and has been that way for 200 years, more than 200 years, and therefore to change that through mere statute, it seems to me, quite apart from the political impossibility of doing it, at least as politics currently stands, I just don't think it's going to wash when challenged in court.
Well, let me ask you, I have another question. I'm sorry, Maria. I'll give you a time in a minute. I know I'm monopolizing sure. things here. But we've had 11 countries copy our Constitution, or at least use it as a framework for their own Constitution. None of them have had this problem. None of them have disenfranchised the people of their capital city. I guess that... You know, again, not being a constitutional expert, but just a novice or you know, a casual observer of this and not trained in it, it seems to me that, you know, we ought to be able to resolve this without a constitutional amendment because certainly those 11 countries did.
Yeah. Well, I can't comment on the constitutions of those 11 countries. They may have provided for the franchise in their constitutions themselves.
They did not. They modified their constitution.
You know, we did not. We, in this country, gave to states the primary function of setting forth the criteria for the franchise. That's why, for example, women got the right to vote in a good number of states before the 19th
Amendment.
The 19th Amendment was ratified, a number of states had provided for the vote for women, not at right. the federal level, of course, but at the state level. And so the fact that the District of Columbia is not a state is generally held to be the reason that the franchise does not apply here, except with respect to local matters, and that's through a provision of Congress, and except as provided by the 23rd Amendment with respect to electors for the presidency.
Maria, do you have a question?
I do. My question is, if you know that it should go through the amendment process, why wouldn't you pursue it that way?
I guess that's a question for Senator Brown, not for me.
It is.
Well, you know what? We have pursued it that way. And unfortunately, we only got 16 states to ratify a constitutional amendment. You understand the process. There's two ways to do it. It can pass through Congress and then go out to the states for ratification, or there can be constitutional conventions in the states themselves. Well, we got to pass through both houses of Congress and put it out to the states, and we only got 16 states, and we need two-thirds of the states. So I think we got about halfway there is what it amounted
Actually,
to.
Actually, you need three-quarters for ratification.
Or three-quarters.
Yeah. And but you see, Senator Brown, that points to the political difficulty that you're up against in this. And let's be candid, this is political. And the recent Gallup poll of July 15th really brought that out in spades. Even among Democrats, support for D.C. statehood stands at only 39%, with 51% opposed. And among Americans generally, it's 29% for support for D.C. statehood, 64% opposed. And so that's, in a fundamental way, what you're up against.
Right. And I wouldn't dispute those numbers except to say that the survey did not explain statehood to people. And you have to be my age, Dr. Pilon, to remember the last time a state was entered into the Union, right? Alaska was it Alaska or Hawaii? I can't remember off the top of my head.
They came in together, but I'm at least as old as you, sir, and I do remember that vividly.
Me too. And what my most vivid memory of it, because I was a child, was that my parents went out and bought a new flag. Because we had a 48, my father was a veteran, we had a 48-star flag, right? And we needed to get us 50. I remember that. And he used to say to me when I was a kid on the 4th of July or whatever day it was, don't use the old flag. We didn't know what to do with the old flag. We didn't throw it out.
Now, relative to the political issue and this poll that the Gallup poll that I just cited, I would put to you this question. Do you really think the American people want to see the federal government reduced to this tiny enclave around the mall? I mean, they're so used to thinking of the District of Columbia as this diamond, as, you know, the seat of the federal government. To think that it would be this tiny enclave sort of is jarring, I would think, to the average American out in Nebraska.
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that. I mean, I don't think that people look at Vatican City and say, oh, it's too tiny, you know, it should be bigger. I think that when, although I will agree with you.
Are you equating the District of Columbia to Vatican City?
Well, I don't know.
I suppose there's corruption in both places.
Dr. Pilon, it really seems to me that we have elected ourselves a pope, I got to tell you, but and a Medici at that. But
I'm not going there.
No, I know, and I don't want you to go there. But I'm just saying that I think that, you know, when you talk about, and you use the word tiny several times, you've used it when you were asked questions by Senator Carper, and I would argue that 10 miles square was tiny for the framers as well. You know, when you look at the size of the states that the colonies that were created, colonies like Florida and Virginia, you know, they're massive. They're hundreds of thousands of square miles. So to put in a clause that says no bigger than 10 miles, I would argue, and this is only speculation on my part, that they put it in there because they didn't understand what the size of the federal government would be, not because they thought that there was, you know, that it had to be bigger. I think what they were saying is that it could be no larger than, you know, as an outer limit, and they weren't really sure. And they weren't really sure about a lot of things, right? I mean, certainly, and I think you make a cogent argument that that's why they put in the amendment process, but make that argument. But certainly they were trying to create something that had never been created before. And when it came to participation, it seems to me that the framers were very, very skittish about it. They didn't even want people who fought in the Revolutionary War to have the right to vote unless they were property owners and they were above the age of 21, which many of them weren't. And that's because they thought, right, it was an agrarian society, and they thought if you don't have a stake in the game, why should you have a vote?
Well, there are a couple of things I can say in response to that.
Please, go ahead.
To be sure, the franchise was limited, but as compared to what? Look around the rest of the world, and we were very advanced with respect to the rest of the world. secondly, you had mentioned they didn't imagine the federal government would be as big as it is today. That's for sure. They imagined a federal government whose powers would be defined and limited. That's Madison in Federalist 45. Today, the powers of the federal government are undefined and all but unlimited. And so the size of the District of Columbia may have been small compared to the size of states, but they imagined a federal government that would be small as well.
Yes, I understand that. And I understand that they, you know, a lot of people say that our grievance lies with Madison in Federalist 43, but I would argue that it really lies more with the veterans who were part of the Pennsylvania riot of 1783, who, that seemed to really have a profound effect on Madison's decision. And I know that Jefferson argued about the disenfranchising of the people that would reside in the District of Columbia, but it really wasn't seen as an issue there because so few of us, there were a few thousand people that lived here in those days. I'm absolutely convinced, and you tell me if you disagree with this, absolutely convinced that they didn't mean to disenfranchise 700,000 people.
Right. Senator Brown, as we discussed before we went on the air, my wife and I have an event that I'm going to have to leave. I'll just wrap up what I had Just wrap up what I said. Again, it seems to me that if we're going to go the 51st state route, because of the history, the long history, because of the enclave clause itself, which created this unique enclave for the seat of the federal government, and because of the 23rd Amendment, this has to be done through constitutional amendment. And if it were to pass Congress, it would be in the courts for some time as the issues were sorted out. And I expect that it would be found unconstitutional, unless you did it through amendment.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see on that. And we certainly disagree. I don't disagree on your on the points you're making. I just disagree that it's fair, and we've got to find a solution for it. And we'll let you go, but I hope you'll come back again so we can discuss this more as we go ahead. Yes. And I'm sorry, okay. Maria. Let me give you one last word before Dr. Pilon leaves.
No, he has to go, and I understand that. I'm just also curious about the Cato Institute
is a think tank. We are a classical liberal think tank, not conservative, not liberal, and we stand for limited government, which ties in with those remarks I made just a moment ago. And we were founded out in California, in San Francisco in 1977, moved to Washington in 1981. I served for 8 years in the Reagan administration, at the end of which I joined Cato to establish the Center for Constitutional Studies. And I've just stepped down on January 1 to become emeritus founding director and emeritus vice president. And I am now working on a book on all these constitutional issues.
Wow. Great. Well, thank you. I hope you hope you do a chapter on what we're talking about, and I hope you and your wife have a great social engagement, whatever that is.
Okay.
And we invite you to come back anytime.
Okay. Good to be with
you,
Senator.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Well, who am I to dispute a constitutional expert? But I will say that I just want to say a few things about Dr. Pilon's testimony before the United States Senate when we testified together. He argued that one of the problems that Madison had and the framers had in Federalist 51 was that each state needed to be a diverse population. And he argues that the District of Columbia doesn't have a diverse enough population. And he means that in the sense of an economic population more than, we think of it racially mostly, but that's not what he's talking about. He would argue.
Are you talking about household income, Democrat?
No, he's talking about if you take a look at a state like California, I think, I shouldn't be talking for him, but I think this is what he means. If you take a state like California, you have agriculture, you have manufacturing. You have all sorts of different types of businesses, where in the District of Columbia, you only have the government. And that's a fallacy. We actually only one in six people that lives in the District of Columbia works for the federal government. More people from Virginia work in the federal government than people that live in Washington, D.C. We actually probably, there's probably more than one in six people that work for public interest groups, like the group that you and I supported over the weekend. Everybody in Washington, no matter who you are and no matter what you think, there's somebody in Washington working for you. If you're conservative, I would argue that the Cato Institute is conservative, or the Heritage Foundation. Or if you're liberal, you certainly have the ACLU and other groups like that. Or, if you're a gun owner, the NRA is here. And if you're an anti-gun advocate, there are plenty of, there's a coalition to stop gun violence. And other, no matter what your issue is, I'm telling you, there's somebody in Washington working in the public interest, not in government, for your interests. So, I think that this is something that we can resolve without a constitutional amendment. I think it's a red herring. It's a very old political trick. If I'm a legislator and you want me to support legislation that I know is not going to pass, I support it. You know what I mean? I mean, if I know it's not going to pass, then it's easy for me. I say, okay. And I think that's what a constitutional amendment is. It's a barrier. They say they know that it's such a high bar, given the politics, that it's almost impossible for us to achieve it.
Well, and there's the Equal Rights Amendment that's languishing for
yes.
decades.
Yes. We're still not that inclusive, are we?
No. So, I was thinking you could just revive that old process that you went, because the ERA was ratified, I think, by Nevada this year. It brought it some, life again, activity, even though the deadline is passed by forever.
Yeah, well, they keep on reintroducing it. And it's only one state short. One more state, and it's there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and how many years has that taken? Since the 80s, right?
No, I was in college working on it. And I got to tell you, I graduated in the 70s. So it was an amendment before Congress in the 70s. But it shows part of the Achilles heel, if you will, in our strategy here in Washington. We think that the righteousness of our cause is going to carry the day. So we don't get out into the states and do the work that we need to do in the field to convince people. As Dr. Pilon said, this recent survey showed that most Americans were against it. That's because we haven't explained it to most Americans. And if you remember, I don't know if you remember this about the Equal Rights Amendment, but there was a housewife from, I want to say, Indiana. Her name was Phyllis Schlafly. And yeah. We laughed at her. She was this woman who was, a throwback to the 50s. She had like a bouffant hairdo, and she was a housewife. And she said, and all the liberals got together and they said, well, the righteousness of our cause is going to carry the day. So what did they do? They did commercials with people like Alan Alda, who came on. I don't know if you remember this. And he said, support ERA. And then they would go to another liberal icon, TV or entertainer or somebody else, and they would say, support ERA. Well, all those people were preaching to the choir. Those were people, Alan Alda didn't get anybody to support the ERA that wouldn't have supported the ERA without him. But meanwhile, Phyllis Schlafly got a woman general, the first woman general, to do TV commercials that said, I'm a woman that's made it in a man's world, and I'm telling you, the ERA is wrong. And that resonated with people. You know, and we're making the same mistake, in my opinion. We don't put any money into this. We don't put any effort into it. The D.C. government doesn't even support the work that I do and the work that our delegation does. They do it begrudgingly. They throw nickels and dimes at us. They degrade us when they can. I mean, it's horrible. You and I talked about it.
Speaking of throwing money at causes, over the weekend, I don't know if you were part of the conversation. So Michael and I participated in the Global Woman Peace Foundation's event that included a gala and award ceremony on Friday at GW, and then a walk from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial and back on Saturday. And there was a real eclectic group of people in attendance, and one of them was a woman from the UK who's now here in the United States working on ending female genital mutilation. And she said the British government was throwing gobs of money at them to help get the legislation going, to help put enforcement in place, to help stop the vacation cutting trips that had been going on. And she said, and you guys, you don't get any? And it was like, yeah, we don't.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me point out that the super fundraiser, the person that won the first prize, was Maria Sanchez. She raised more money than anybody else. And I understand that people had been doing it for a very long time, whereas Maria did it for like 10 days, you know, and which is a testimony not only to how wonderful she is, but how well-respected she is. So congratulations on that. And, we just don't know about it. I talked to on this particular issue, I talked to the lady that was sitting next to me. I don't know if you remember her, blonde lady that had the cutest dog I've ever seen. It was like something you could put in your pocket, and she was a surgeon. Yeah. And I said to her, you know, it's funny, we're having a doctor and his wife, a pediatrician and his wife, for dinner tonight. And I said, and I bet she doesn't even know about this. And she said, I talk to gynecologists every day that have never heard of it. So that's a big, again, it's really not much different than the problem that we have, is people need to know about this. You know, Maria, when I go outside the District of Columbia, I'm treated like every other politician. We have a caller online, too. You want to put her on, Lynn? Yeah. Lynn, are you out there?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. What's up?
Yes, I would just, Senator Brown and Maria Sanchez, your media propaganda background and what's going on, I was just wondering, are you guys, what do you know about the impeachment university that's giving Zoom and online programs, and what do you know about it?
I've never heard of it.
Me too. That's the first I've heard of it.
Yeah, this is the first I've heard of it. And we were going to ask Dr. Pylon, unfortunately we didn't get time, whether it was constitutional, whether we were required under the Constitution to have a vote to impeach the president. I don't think we are, although we've always had one in the past. But
Lynn,
what can you tell us,
programs tomorrow online. It's a huge network. It's called Impeachment University. And then there's another fellow that's affiliated with BBS Radio, Rich Presida, and he has Bible studies for progressives. And then there's also a movement, Christians for Impeachment. So I just wondered, they might be able to help in a lot of different situations that are going on, and just wondered if you knew about them.
No, we don't, but we encourage listeners to listen to that stuff and form an opinion about it. Impeachment is, that's all we're talking about in Washington, Lynn. It's really all we're talking about these days. And, for the sake of transparency, I should point out that there have only been two presidents, I believe, impeached, and both of them were Democrats. So, real
quick, Maria, I'm sorry to jump in, Maria. Rich Procida, he's a constitutional lawyer, and he's way high up in Social Security admin in California. And I just thought you might want to connect with him. Because he's a constitutional lawyer and he has Bible studies for progressives. And he's involved, I believe, with that impeachment university. And he was highly involved with the Poor People's Campaign Group, .org.
So, Lynn, how are you so aware of this? Do you have a personal passion about what's going on, or are you always a political junkie?
Oh, yes. I have an Oregon change agent certificate since 2011 from a three-time governor who's a medical doctor for my work with jobs creation.
Well, thank you for the good work you're doing, Lynn. And, you know, this is going to be a tough time for America. Impeachment is never an easy thing to go through. As we remember Richard Nixon, resigned from office prior to being impeached, and when it looked like he was going to be impeached, and it was a terrible time for the country, and we're going through a tough time right now as well. So although this is something I think that many people feel compelled to pursue, I don't think it's something that any of us look forward to.
No, it's definitely going to hurt. I hope there's not a whole bunch of collateral damage, but obviously it needs to be done, and hopefully it will be done expeditiously with not a lot of wounds.
Well, thank you for calling in, Lynn. We appreciate your
comment.
Lynn,
that was much appreciated.
And let me take a moment of personal privilege here to say that the issue of D.C. statehood and the people of Baltimore and Howard County this week lost a champion in Elijah Cummings. Elijah Cummings.
I'm sorry, Michael, I saw your post on Facebook, and that was my first knowledge. And then when I landed in D.C., the flags were at half mast.
Yeah. Yeah, he was an amazing legislator, not only in the sense that he was just a good guy. You know, he was somebody that I met with on more than one occasion briefly, and he was just a good guy, and he was head of the Government Oversight and Reform Committee, which meant that he was at the forefront of the, hearings that were that Congress is contemplating on impeachment. So that in itself is going to have impact on the whole process, I think, choosing a new chairman and where they go with that. But he was an amazing man. My condolences go out to his wife, Maya, and their two children.
Brought into the Baltimore fray that President Trump talked about?
Yeah, he was what President Trump said. He was the guy that President Trump attacked. President Trump really didn't attack Baltimore. He attacked Elijah Cummings. And he said that Elijah Cummings was a congressman from a rat-infested dump, and he should focus on taking care of the people of Baltimore rather than focusing on the president of the United States. So he insulted Baltimore, but he did it via insulting Elijah Cummings. And that's one problem with this
just
guy,
got
right?
The Baltimore
he has no line.
Insult.
What? I'm sorry, Maria.
I just got the Baltimore insults. I didn't get that he made it personal.
Yeah. It was in response to something that Cummings was, some comments Cummings made about impeachment. And of course, Cummings being the head of the committee on government reform, was an important statement that he made. And, that's another thing. I can't leave the subject without saying that one thing that was really unique about Elijah Cummings is that he reached across the aisle. And that's so rare. We've really lost a champion because look, the bottom line is we have to work together. We have to work together, and we're so polarized. Even in my movement, you know, I've got to tell you, there are lots of people in Washington, D.C. working on D.C. statehood, but me and my staff are the only people that I know of in the last 2 years that have met with any Republicans about this. You know, we've gotten 220 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives, all Democrats, 34 in the Senate, all Democrats. But we're never going to pass the legislation unless we get Republicans, because we need 60 votes to pass it. And the most, generous predictions about what the Democrats have a chance of doing in the Senate is ending up 52-48 in the Senate. So we're still going to be 7 or 8 votes short, and it's not going to happen unless we get Republicans on board or unless we get rid of the filibuster. And it's not likely. Right. I don't know why anybody in the minority would want to get rid of the filibuster. You know what I mean? The filibuster is as bizarre and ancient as it seems.
I was going to say antiquated.
Antiquated. Thank you. That's the right word. As it seems, it keeps you from passing legislation with 51 votes. Now, if the Democrats have 52 votes and they can pass every piece of legislation that comes their way against the Republicans really wouldn't have much of a say. Do you think the Republicans are going to go along with getting rid of the filibuster? I don't think so. And if it's reversed and the Republicans have control, you think the Democrats are going to go along with getting rid of the filibuster? I don't think so.
No,
so I think the filibuster is there at least for the foreseeable future. And if we don't get some Republicans, we're not going to make it happen. In America, we have to come together. I mean, that's the bottom line. We have to come together.
Well, and coming together is somewhat nebulous, but I would suggest if we could identify, say, 5 or 6 topics or legislations or ways of life that we could agree on, then maybe that would fuel the bipartisanship-ness of politics that, you know what, they're people too, and they have families too, and they live in neighborhoods too, and they go to school too, and they have pets too, and, you know, so then suddenly you start to realize you have more, like you and I, Michael, that we have more in common than we don't.
Well, and you know what, I've said this many times, that's a technique I use in dealing with Republicans, Maria, that when Republicans make me mad sometimes, they make me really, really mad. And I think of all the people like you and members of my family that I care deeply about that are Republicans. And I say, look, you know, it's not about Republican or Democrat. It's about having a different opinion, because there are plenty of Republicans that I know personally who are decent people who care about America the same as I do. And that's the problem when we get to, when we get to vilify people and put labels on them, and we make all these assumptions about them. You know, look, I'm a liberal Democrat, and I take my hat off, stand up, and put my hand over my heart every time they bring the flag out, because I'm proud to be an American, and I'm proud of the fact and the knowledge that I have that in any other country, if I had been orphaned at 15 years old as a high school dropout on myself, I would have never, ever made it. America has been good to me, my family, and everybody I know, and I'm proud of it. And, you know, the assumption that I'm not because I'm a liberal, or the presumption that people that support Donald Trump are idiots, you know, that has to go away. And that only happens when we objectify each other and stop looking at each other as people.
That's correct. That's, you know, put people in a box, frame them into a compartment, and then you're not dealing with the person, you're dealing with a concept.
Well, let's, we're running out of time. Here's a song from one of my favorites, Dave Mason, in honor of Dr. Pilon, who stepped over the line and came into dangerous territory. We both testified together, so he understood fully that we were at opposite ends of the spectrum, but he showed up anyway, and we thank him for that.
He was eloquent and articulate and intelligent and thoughtful. and I think a huge asset to our program. And again, want to thank our listeners for making us a priority in their busy weeks, because we appreciate your continued dedication and your ears.
And that's why this woman raised so much money, because she cares about you, and in return, people care about her. Have a nice week.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.